We have got Mike Monaco with us here in the studio. And the Jason Van Dyke trial is in recess at the moment. We thought it had ended for the day. May not. The judge is Judge Gaughan, who's a no-nonsense. Would you? Is that a best way to describe him?
Yeah, I think that's right.
No-nonsense judge is keeping everything to the vest. He's got everything in his own orbit here, and he does not letting outside courtroom issues like the live coverage of it or anything like that get in the way of, you know, how he wants the jury to be or to be, you know, to feel and to see all the things he can do. I mean, it's an interesting job that the judge has, because he has to basically be the advocate for the jury, right?
Yeah, I credit all the folks over there with having the live TV coverage of it. I think that's a good thing. I think it's a very good thing. So I'm happy that he's doing that. And Judge Gaughan does like to have a lot of private conversations with the lawyers in his chambers. And that's unfortunate, but that's how he is.
But that's not unusual, is it?
It's somewhat unusual. I mean, he's more secret about things than most judges, I would say. Although he's done a good job, I think, so far.
Here's a moment where Judge Gaughan, is this from today or is this from yesterday? Today, where Judge Gaughan did not like the theatrics of the prosecution's case.
In fact, a trauma team actually cut open his chest.
All right, stop. That's enough. Move on.
Well, did those five doctors work on him for practice, or were they trying to help a person remain alive?
Yes. As to the form of the question, sustained. You have to establish that he was alive at the time if you want to go into it.
Did any of the doctors tell you when the five of them were working on Laquan McDonald that they were working on a dead person?
Objection.
Sustained. Stay away from this right now, all right? Ask him if he had any personal knowledge whether Mr. McDonald was alive or dead, all right? And stop the drama, too,
Ooh.
All right?
Ouch.
That sounds
a warning.
That sounds like Judge Gaughan. Yeah, that sounds just like Judge Gaughan.
Yeah. Well,
because he's used to dealing with murder cases.
Sure.
I mean, they do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that things are anything about this would be changed because it's televised? Because that's always the fear and the justification when in the past when they've not allowed cameras is that people act for the cameras or that things get more dramatic.
That's what you're exactly right. That's what they say. It's not been my experience, and friends of mine in New York and other places where they have televised trials, it's not been their experience. They say what it does is it heightens everybody. Everybody's more ready. Everybody's ready to perform and not go beyond the ordinary dramatics that you would have in a courtroom. And this is a pretty dramatic event. I mean, young man died.
Right. And the camera coverage of this, it's not like OJ, right? I mean, that became a cottage industry. That became its own economy, its own ecosystem. And this is, you know, this is a trial that is going to, you know, probably last 3-4 more trial days, perhaps, before.
Right. It's going to be over soon.
Yeah. Hmm. And so this is not a,
That's good you brought up OJ. Remember in OJ, when one of the prosecutors wore a medal on her chest or some ornament on her chest in sympathy for the victim. And in, you know, I think the victim's family is also wearing the same thing on her chest. The judge in that case took 45 minutes of argument over whether she should be allowed to wear.
Gaughan wouldn't do that.
Would say, take it off, let's go. You know, that's all it would be.
Take it off for now.
That's
we'll
all.
Deal
take
with it
off.
Later.
Right.
I think that's where we had the dancing Itos.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in the mid-1990s. All right, let's talk about what was at stake there, though. This is an interesting point.
Right, it is interesting. When
did Laquan McDonald die? And the question is, at the time, you notice Chicago police officers, and this is not going to, I don't think, play well, even though this may not have to do specifically with Jason Van Dyke. It certainly does not portray the Chicago Police Department in the best light that after this kid, even with a knife and all of the, you know, the justification that a lot of people in the police department feel was was rightful in terms of the shooting of Laquan McDonald, if not for 16 times, but at least in the initial shots, it seems to me that there is kind of a negative impact of them standing there around him as he's on the ground.
Nobody went to save
him. No one went to save him until a sheriff's officer, right. A sheriff's police officer,
came by.
Arrived.
Wasn't even assigned to the scene. He just showed up.
Well, they're assigned to that area. They are in that sector.
Yeah.
They
but he saw
here.
The police who were being called to the scene. He wasn't called to the scene, and yeah. He showed up.
Yeah,
but no one else rendered aid. He was the guy who did it.
And you'd have to, I'm not sure if that's common in police shootings. It seems to be common that it doesn't happen, right? That nobody rushes. If someone, someone is shot, nobody rushes to the scene to help them. Or it's unlikely. It's
but
not
when you
a common
see that in
thing.
A video, it may not
you've
be common.
Video,
you've
it's
seen
tough.
A video, it's
very,
hard.
It's very,
it is hard
it's
to
very
watch.
Tough.
And Chicago Fire Department paramedic said this on the stand.
You applied a monitor?
Yes, sir.
What did you find when you applied a monitor?
On a monitor, I believe he had a rhythm. Yeah. Possibly in the 60.
Okay, he had a rhythm.
Yes, sir.
What do you mean by a rhythm?
He had a heart rate. There was a pulse, and it showed on the cardiac monitor.
Okay. And approximately what was his rhythm or heart rate at that time?
I believe it was like 60. I don't know exact number.
And when you say 60, is that beats per minute? Or?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so if by the time CFD has gotten there, fire has gotten there, and they put him up on the gurney and they get him into the truck and they start wiring him up, if he has a pulse rate of 60, the argument could be that he was certainly alive when he was on the ground.
Right, and that if your point is right, is well taken, that nobody did anything to try to save him. What does that mean? Is that now? It's not just Van Dyke that did nothing. None of the other policemen were there did anything.
But how does that work into these charges?
It hurts.
Van Dyke?
It hurts Van Dyke because it makes it look like they didn't care. That he did not care if this fellow lived or died, and that's what it sounds like.
Well, but there were other officers there,
and none of them cared.
But
is Van Dyke though? Is the shooter in a situation like that when a police officer shoots somebody? Justified, let's just assume in a justified shooting. I thought at that point they're supposed to not be a part of anything that goes on here.
I think that's right, and normally it's just one or two policemen are there. Now here you have five or six policemen there, so it's
yeah.
different.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just you're right, if it's just one other, if it's the fellow who did the shooting should not be involved in, I suppose. But here this the whole point is this: it goes to intent. Was it their intention? Was it Officer Van Dyke's intention to kill this young man? That's what the state has to prove.
Does it go the other way though? Is there a way that the defense here can say, well, you know, he shot him 16 times, but he didn't initially kill him? Now, I guess the question is, and I don't know where they're going to go here with the testimony in terms of pathology, but is the question that he needed to neutralize the threat. So he does. This kid had a knife. He was moving a beam them and then appears to be turning toward them. That's when the shots are fired and that's when he goes
If
down.
He had only shot Laquan McDonald once and he fell to the ground,
mm-hmm.
would we have a murder case?
No, I don't think we
Probably
would.
Probably not. No. Stacey St. Clair with the Tribune, who's doing some excellent reporting on this, said that today the defense really focused on trying to convince the jury that those two lethal shots came while Laquan McDonald was still standing
Early.
And still a threat, meaning number two and number four, I think they were isolating. Right. And so they're trying to say that that's when those are the ones that actually killed him. Those are the lethal shots.
You remember we talked about this months ago when mm-hmm. we first heard about this. I said at the time, if the first shot killed him, then the defense could say that the other 15 shots are irrelevant. Doesn't matter.
Well,
he still has to explain why he did them. And I don't know. I don't think in their opening statement he didn't explain it.
No.
So we'll see if they're going to call.
Do you think he'll be on trial? Do you think
he'll
go on?
I can't imagine
he's going
to testify. I don't think he has to testify. I'm curious what he'll say. Why he kept shooting? I don't think he can say why he kept shooting.
Well, there isn't. People have speculated that there are going to be witnesses here that are going to testify to the psychology
right.
of these incidents.
That these things make people act in a way that's
right.
normally
the
not
tunnel vision
right.
concept that
right.
that they're only you know the whole the all of the exterior things that are happening around them go away. The context goes away. All they know is they
or that
a guy
or that police trainers are going to say that they're trained to keep shooting.
Right.
They're trained to shoot
and to reload, which he did.
They're trained to keep
shooting. Even the witness
and reload.
On the scene who said that it looked like Laquan was walking away said he couldn't remember how many shots it were. He said a few. I mean, right. it's hard to even know when you're in
that
scene. Well,
the shots
came
so fast, too. Right.
And that weapon does fire quickly. I mean, you can empty that weapon in just a matter of seconds.
Sure. Yeah. And so it's going to I guess it will come down to why did he shoot 16 times after the first couple of shots? Why did he keep shooting?
After he was on the ground.
After Laquan McDonald's on the ground. But my point is, other policemen at the scene, I'm told, are going to say, and although this hasn't come into evidence yet, hold your fire.
Hmm. Even though there's no, is there any audio to reflect that?
There's
no audio of anything.
That's the funny thing. There's no audio.
All right. Well, we'll see what comes in evidence. But at this point, what we're looking at is the issue of dead or alive at the scene. And once fire arrived fairly quickly.
Right.
So you had the sheriff's officer. Step up and put on, he testified yesterday, he put on some rubber gloves and
right.
he went down and tried to see if he could administer some.
And he told McDonald that the ambulance was coming.
Right. And he didn't seem to think that there was much of a response from Laquan McDonald at that moment.
Right.
He seemed to be unconscious at that. But when they got him into the
ambulance, he was still alive.
Right. The human body is amazingly resilient in those last moments of life. It in terms of heartbeat and stuff like that. I mean, people who have had sad vigil with people who are going to pass away. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Well, this is such a traumatic event. I mean, 24 times bullets went through this fellow's body. I mean, 16 shots, 24 different. Bullet holes.
Right.
So this fellow suffered a great, horrible trauma within the last few minutes of his life. So it's hard to say how he was going to survive that.
Mike Monaco, do you think that these last couple of days, this is the prosecution's main case
here? Yes, absolutely.
Is it going well for them?
This is their case. Why did he shoot 16 times? And that's the question that the defense will have to answer. Why he shot 16 times? Now, are they going to call experts? I think they may want to call experts because I can't imagine, although they may.
Is Gone going to let them do that?
They may, yeah.
I mean, can you really call an expert that gets into the mind of somebody who's not testified? Doesn't the defendant at this point have to testify?
You can get an expert to training as to how police officers train.
Right.
And you get an officer, you can get someone to say that this is not unusual that a person keeps shooting because policemen are taught that way, and this is how policemen and the psychology of it is. Once you're in this dramatic, horrible situation, this most stressful situation of your life, how are you going to act? It's hard to say how you're going to act.
All right, let's get a couple answers here from people who actually do this job. Nick is a police officer. Nick, you're on WGN. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, thank you, guys. To clarify, I have law enforcement experience. I am not currently at law enforcement status.
Okay.
But I think what's important to discern here is the definition of lethal force and the interpretations of what that means. Just as a quick starting point, a police officer is trained to apply lethal force when the threat of great bodily harm or imminent death is still present. So what he has to answer is why there was still an imminent threat of bodily harm and death throughout every single shot. And I think that it's apparent that his continued movement or threat to the other officers ended quite earlier than that. And then as far as duty of care goes, through training, they definitely show police officers other officer-involved shooting videos. But the simple oath that a police officer swears way back when they first started is to protect human life. So no matter who you are, whether you were the one that pulled the trigger, and I'm only speaking of this through other officer experiences, you immediately follow up with that medical care. I've personally seen videos where right after a justified use of deadly force was administered by an officer, he immediately put on his gloves, and I'm talking seconds. And through the stress in his voice, you could hear that he really did want to save that person and was upset at the decisions that everyone had to make that day. But it's important to know that you do know as an officer, you immediately follow up with medical care. And you also stop shooting when somebody stops being a threat.
Nick, would all officers, though, have that kind of training, CPR-type training, in order to be able to do that?
Absolutely. It's called first responder medical training.
They all have it.
And the most important, and they do have it, and the most important way they're taught it, actually, is for each other. So the use of tourniquets, ever since mass shootings, have been more heavily looked at training-wise. Every officer is trained to react to major wounds.
All right. Thank you very much. Helpful. Appreciate it. I want to go back to this notion, if we can, just for a second here, about the importance and which side benefits more from the notion that Laquan McDonald died on the scene versus died during transport.
I think the main issue there is about the police, and especially Mr. Van Dyke, not going to seek help for Laquan McDonald. In other words, he was already dead. There was no need to seek, no need to do any CPR, anything on the scene, because it would have been of no value. I assume that's why they're bringing
him. And the prosecutors here would argue that because he didn't try to save him, that went to his intent to murder?
That's what I think they're going to argue, that they didn't care. I say they, I mean, it's just Mr. Van Dyke.
Right, but in this particular, but there were other officers there who could have rendered it, and it took a county sheriff's officer, who at the time it would be tough to distinguish at that moment,
right
for anybody, but who at least said to him, hey, the ambulance is on the way, because they knew that fire was rolling immediately on shots fired.
Ambulance was coming. So it's, you know, this is a very, very quick incident. We talked about this yesterday. There's not much evidence here. The biggest issue is that the policeman shot 16 times. That's the biggest issue. And the second issue is, why didn't anybody go to help him? Why didn't Officer Van Dyke then go to try to help the fellow he had just shot 16 times? Either because he realized that his shots had killed him, or because he didn't care. So that either side can argue either way. I mean, the state's going to argue they didn't care. This goes to their intent. I say there. It's only one person's intent,
right.
Van Dyke's intent.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the things that when we have this debate, which we're having so much more now because of the ubiquity of video in these cases, is the behavior of police in the aftermath of a shooting. And it seems that in a case where you do have the victim lying there on the ground unattended, and we've seen this before.
Oh yeah, police are going to have to change. They're going to have to change their procedures. They're going to have to, with the advent of cameras, they're going to have to act after a shooting like they care to save the person who's shot. As the officer who just called in, or former officer, said, their number one duty is duty to care, duty to help people. That's what they have to do.
I talked to a police officer, though, just while we were in the break here, who texted me and said that they learn in the academy CPR, but that there isn't, in his case, he didn't learn later. Again, you're not necessarily refreshed on your CPR and your first responder duties. And he said that he typically sees they wait for the paramedic if they're only minutes away to do that. That seems...
I suppose
something
that's true,
happens.
Because there's not much they can do. What could a police officer have done to help?
And can they make it worse? I mean, that's the other thing. Fear that you
if,
have.
If you move him at all,
yeah.
If you move him at all, it could make it worse.
Right. So yeah. I mean, that becomes a question, and that becomes a generally a civil litigation issue,
right, at some point too. Right.
But the real issue here is justifiability. Mm-hmm. Was the firing of the weapon justifiable?
If the first shot was justified, and if that killed him, then there is, I think Herbert said in his opening statement, it's not a crime.
So one of the, on Windy City Live today, one of the activists, the primary activist of this case, one of the guys who was able to get the video released, was on the program with us. And the argument is being made here, and we'll have a chance, I think, to talk to him tomorrow, and I know they're planning a protest on Monday at the court. The argument is made that the police were, the other police weren't shooting. There was another officer following behind Laquan McDonald on foot. The officer who had been in the police vehicle that Laquan McDonald had punctured the tire of and actually then, you know, stabbed without much impact the windshield mm-hmm. of that vehicle as well. But, you know, clearly Laquan McDonald was, we now know, but he was, you know, he was on PCP and he was a little out of his mind, right, at this moment. He did have this knife. He had displayed this knife. And people are like, well, it's, you know, it's a pocket knife. It's a 3-inch knife. What is it? It doesn't really count. And that police officer didn't shoot at Laquan McDonald, the one from behind. And I said, well, if Laquan McDonald had turned around and approached that officer, he would have shot. Well, that's speculation, and it's also a hypothetical. But the point is, the knife is the threat. Mm-hmm. Not, I'm trying to just point out that the knife, in this case, is a deadly weapon. A three-inch blade is a deadly weapon.
It is absolutely deadly. And it's not just the knife. It's the fact that of how he was dealing with the knife. He was using it as a weapon. I mean, that's why he had the knife. He's not holding it in a defensive posture. He's using it in an aggressive posture.
Right. But you have other police officers at the scene who chose not to use lethal force, and you wonder how convincing that will be to the jury.
That's
you can
true.
Say there are different vantage points, different perspectives, and I think that's what the partner of Jason Van Dyke
officer,
argued,
yeah,
that you don't
Walsh.
See it from my vantage point. There's no body cam available, but you do have a number of police officers who did not use lethal force. I just, you know, that testimony is there, and you wonder how compelling that will be to the jury.
That'll be the issue. Was the shooting justified? If it was justified, the issue, the fact that he did 16 times, how does that control the issue? It may be that the prosecutor is going to say it means that he was in. This shows why he should be convicted of murder, because he was intending to kill this fellow. The defense will say no. If he had shot the first time and that was a fatal shot, the other shot's really irrelevant. You know.
Will the jury buy that, though?
No, they have to. I think somebody's got to explain why he shot him 16 times. Either, mm-hmm. like we talked about earlier, either it's the emotion of it, the trauma of that the police officer is going through with his own trauma. This mm-hmm. is a traumatic event for him.
Right.
Having
his family.
First time ever shooting a gun in the line of duty. So it's a traumatic thing for everybody, but is that going to justify the 16 bullets? Hard to say.
All right. Eric Rung has been following the story for us, for WGN Radio, WGN TV, and CLTV. And he's joining us now from the WGN TV newsroom. And it is interesting today. There was a lot of the big headline today, as we've just been discussing, is about the timeline of death here. But also, at the very end of the day, they brought back one of the technical witnesses here. This is an FBI witness who was testifying about the videotape that shows the puffs of smoke with the during the firing of the gun at Laquan McDonald. They threw that testimony out yesterday. Now they're bringing it back in. What happened there, Eric?
So before court got started today, the judge met with both the attorneys for the defense as well as the prosecution. The prosecution had asked the judge to reconsider throwing that testimony out. The judge said, well, it was really confusing. I wasn't really quite sure what they were trying to say, but, you know, I'll think about it. And then eventually he said, okay, we will allow him to testify, but on a limited basis. Now, the one thing that was really the point of contention yesterday was this FBI video forensic expert started testifying on bullets and the bullets that he had put green arrows on that he said were coming out of Laquan McDonald. Puffs of smoke. You heard that yesterday mm-hmm. several times.
And that's an exit wound, right? Is
right.
that what that had been?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. However, the defense came up and they said, wait a second, you're a video expert. You're not a ballistics expert. How do you know this? And the prosecution today, when they went in to talk with the judge, said, we understand the why you threw it out yesterday. However, his testimony is consistent with the medical examiner's reports. That is why the judge allowed him to testify once again here today. So the testimony could be on the record. But again, it was in a very limited form. You'll remember yesterday, he was probably on the stand for a good half hour, 45 minutes. The jury saw the video of Laquan McDonald being shot by Jason Van Dyke over and over
right.
again.
Slow motion, wasn't it? unit,
in slow motion. Yes, exactly. So regardless, whether or not they saw that again here today or not, if it would have been thrown out, the jury had already seen it.
But that's the hard part, I think. The judge in this case today said completely disregard what you heard from this same expert yesterday, even his name, and let's start from scratch. And I always feel like that's really hard for a jury to do.
Okay, we're just going
to
unring that bell.
slow motion video we saw for half an hour.
Eric, I thought the prosecution today also said that they're going to call the ballistics expert, who the forensics person, the video forensic person, relied
upon. Who he sat with, right?
Right. So they're going to call the ballistics person himself?
That I'm unaware of. All I'm aware of is what I was told happened between the attorneys and the judge and why he was allowed to testify today. That would make sense for them to definitely call that ballistic experts that he did sit with to make those decisions on where to put those green arrows.
May I ask a question here, just in Mr. Monaco, in terms of watching this videotape by the jury over and over and over again? I know we talked about this on the first day of the trial, but now here we are on the third day of testimony. Does watching that tape over and over and over again dull the jury to what is happening here?
It could.
Or does it further?
It could. It could. I mean, your point is, is it overkill by the state to keep showing it, or is it some way helping the defense to keep showing it?
Right.
It's hard to say. I think it is such a...
There isn't like a hard and fast rule on
it. No hard and fast rule. It's clear that when someone sees a violent act over and over again, the person, it starts, it's less emotional as the first time you see it.
Right. It's inoculated to it.
But there's somewhat inoculated to it. But it's hard to say because this is such a... It's a very short thing, and so it's a very short period of time, and so it's important that the jury for the defense, excuse me, for both sides, it's important that the jury understands what happened.
And this is this particular video that we're talking about here with the puffs of smoke, which are the exit wounds of that's the blood and tissue, it's not smoke, that's coming through there, it appears to be. That is, you know, as that's being explained, I mean, this is the most gruesome part of this,
right,
and certainly the most violent part of this. And to your point earlier, if you want to, you know, talk about, you know, does a guy who's hopped up on PCP, who's carrying a knife, who, you know, the people see this video two different ways. Some people see this video as he's walking away from the police and just trying to get away, which they're not going to let him get away with a knife, right? No one's going to let him do that and go back toward a fast food restaurant or a strip mall, which is, you know, a couple hundred feet away from where he was actually shot, or then there's the, you know, the people who say, well, he was turning, stepped on the line, he turned his shoulder, he was about to lunge at the officers when they took the shot, which is what their paperwork showed. And the video, you know, I think the argument that the defense is going to use is that the video is really not conclusive in that.
Right, and that's what Walsh was saying yesterday, that from his view and Van Dyke's view, the victim seemed to turn towards them and raise his arm. That's what he said.
Or open his shoulders to them raise his arm. My question on that is, when the prosecution went to redirect Officer Walsh, or former Officer Walsh, why they only asked him that one question of, why don't we see that on the video? And he said, well, that's not my perspective. Why not go further on that? I mean, regardless of what the video shows, I mean, and the arm is still an arm, and you could see it go up or down when Officer Van Dyke comes out. I didn't understand why there was no follow-up questions there.
Well, they don't control that. I mean, you know, normally policemen are in the hands of the prosecutor. Here, this policeman, Officer Walsh, a former Officer Walsh, was not in their hands, and so they were afraid of him, frankly.
So they just weren't sure of the answer. That's why they didn't ask a question.
But he'd been given immunity,
yeah,
hadn't he?
Yeah, didn't he do an immunity deal?
He'd been given immunity, but I'm sure he had been coached by the defense as well, you know, because the defense asked him questions like, which the key question was, somebody had to stop him, didn't they? And he said, yes, somebody had to stop him.
Right.
Yeah, he was a dangerous man. Yeah. Correct. Yes.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. Appreciate it, sir.
Thanks,
Eric Rung from WGN TV, WGN Radio, CLTV. We're all part of one gigantic item. And Mike Monaco, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We appreciate you.
Nice
spending your time here.
You too, Mike.
Thank you. This has been
always like to see you.
See you tomorrow.
Yes, we will see you tomorrow. There's more of this, and we don't know if there's actually going to be trial on Friday. It is unclear at this this writing, if that is actually going to happen. Would you anticipate, just quickly here, a couple more days of prosecution?
Yes.
And then do you think the defense will mount a long case or short case?
I think the defense, I don't know. Normally from an opening statement, you get some idea of what the defense is going to do, but you couldn't tell from this opening statement whether they're going to call experts.
And it depends on how they thought this went.
Or whether they're calling other witnesses or not. Again, if they call Officer Van Dyke, he could be on a half a day. But I just don't know what he would say that would help him. I mean, even it's very hard for a person who committed an act to say why he committed it. You know what I'm saying? Why did you shoot 16 times? I was afraid. After the 14th time, were you afraid? After the, and you could see a difficult cross-examination for him.
Sure, you could. But sometimes it's helpful, too, for the jury to have the answer about why.
Maybe they'll figure out some way to put it in without having him testify.
More details to come. Thank you all very much. That does it for another day of Broadcast Insolence from the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. We'll see you back here on 720 AM and WGN everywhere tomorrow at 3:00.